Lecture 6, How to Maintain Relationships with Talk.
My mother once said to me, "Remember, the person you marry is the person you will talk to every day for the rest of your life." Wow. That is a reminder of how important talk is in our personal relationships, both with romantic partners and with friends. Now, one of the central concerns about personal relationships is often miscommunication, that somehow the other person isn't hearing what we really mean, and hence the relationship gets rocky. And when people are talking about heterosexual relationships, they sometimes worry that men and women have trouble communicating well with each other. So I'll start with that issue, and then we'll turn to the issue of how you align your language with someone else's language. Then, how parenting is all wrapped up in being a conversational role model. And finally, how what we've talked about throughout this course applies to electronic conversations. To talk about possible sources of miscommunication, I want to distinguish between two different kinds of conversational floors: a cooperative conversational floor and a competitive conversational floor. With a more cooperative conversational floor, speakers are collaboratively building a text. That is, they're all contributing to the development of a conversational topic and then collaboratively moving to another topic. They're working as a group. With a more competitive conversational floor, speakers are attempting to get the floor from other speakers and hence the spotlight so that they can talk about what they want to talk about or in some ways outdo another speaker. There are stereotypes out there and some linguistic studies that support them that all male groups tend to have a more competitive conversational floor and all female groups tend to have a more cooperative conversational floor. For men, this can take the form of a kind of verbal one-upmanship, for example, in joke-telling or in verbal insults. There are some wonderful parodies out there of this kind of conversation. For example, the comedy group The Harvard Sailing Team did a skit in which the women had a quote-unquote male conversation while they sat around watching sports. So here's part of what happens. One woman says, "Yo, you guys starving?" Another woman responds, while looking at the TV, "I want like chili cheese fries with jalapeno peppers." Another says, "500 tacos." And finally a fourth chimes in, "4 dozen pepperoni donuts." And she's texting while she says it. So what's happening here is each speaker is making a statement about what she wants to eat, each potentially more outrageous than the last. So they're going one up on each other. The men on the Harvard sailing team doing the reverse skit play it out this way. So they're playing out what a woman's conversation would be stereotypically. One woman asks the group, "Hey, are you guys hungry or something?" Another responds, "You know, I could share something." A third then says, "Okay, let me call Rebecca and just make sure that we're not going out later." So here we see speakers coordinating plans and building on each other's turns using things like, "you know," and then picking up on that person's speech. Now these are funny in part because they are stereotypes of how men and women talk. Now those stereotypes don't come from nowhere, but real life is also much more complicated. Men can certainly talk collaboratively and women competitively, as we'll talk about. And if you think about a one-upmanship game, like what I want to eat right now, the game works only if everyone plays by an agreed-upon set of rules, which is really a kind of playful cooperation on the conversational floor. It's not that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. We're all very much from the same planet. But we're often socialized to talk in different ways. And one potential difference is what speakers see as the primary goal of a conversation. For example, are we talking as a way to bond or as a way to exchange information? Or are we doing both? It's important to realize that talk can serve different functions in a personal relationship, including telling people things and maintaining intimacy. Linguist Deborah Tannen refers to these two different things as report talk and rapport talk. And it can be very helpful to figure out which kind of talk you're participating in at any given moment. Report talk is about relaying information, often about more impersonal topics. So talking about what happened that day or talking about something that happened in the news. Rapport talk focuses on personal experiences and emotions and is a way to establish and maintain intimacy among friends and among romantic partners. These two kinds of talk are often seen as gendered, that men do more report talk and women do more rapport talk. I have to say, I think it's complicated. Report talk about something like sports or even the news can do a lot of work among speakers to establish connections. And rapport talk, of course, also conveys information. But nonetheless, I think it's helpful for speakers to step back and consider whether they're in a situation where the talk itself is the point, more than the specific content of the talk. For example, we're talking about a problem as a way of sharing what is happening, as opposed to an informational exchange designed to solve the problem. In intimate relationships, talk can be a kind of intimacy, a way of checking in with someone else, and perhaps, most importantly, I think, a way of feeling connected with that other person. Talk can be as or more intimate than any kind of physical intimacy, and it is important to remember that. So here's one way that an intimate conversation can go wrong. Let's imagine that there's a couple sitting down to dinner at the end of the day and asking how the other person's day went. Now, if we're honest about it, most of our days do not involve anything earth-shattering. And so if that is the bar, we would all say, fine, in response to how was your day, and leave it at that. But often, the conversation about how your day was is more about sharing as a conversational practice than about sharing anything especially newsworthy. It's about letting someone know about the rhythms of your day, the bizarre but minor things that happen in your day, how you're feeling, what you're thinking about. If you just say fine, you're shutting down that form of connection. And so it can feel like a rebuff of intimacy rather than just a statement about a boring day. So this kind of talk is more often about rapport, and it's important to remember that if someone asks you that at the end of the day, to think about how do I want to respond and keep this conversation going. Now, here's another way that an intimate conversation can go wrong, and it's also related to the difference between report and rapport talk. This involves the difference between sharing a problem and solving a problem. So let's imagine a couple, a married couple, husband and wife, and the wife says to her husband, I can't believe how much I'm being asked to do at work right now. There are a couple of possible responses from the husband here. One is, have you talked with your boss about it? Another is, that is so aggravating. What are you being asked to do? These responses take the purpose of the wife's complaint to be very different. If the husband sees this as report talk, so that his wife's purpose is primarily the communication of information, it can seem like the logical purpose of her sharing the problem is to seek a solution. But perhaps she's sharing the problem as a kind of rapport talk, that she's venting and looking for sympathy or empathy and not necessarily a solution. Or maybe she wants both. If so, it could be helpful to do some rapport talk first to let her talk it out before turning to possible solutions, because the solutions may involve directives or advice and other face-threatening acts. If you find yourself as a listener in this situation and you're thinking, I'm really not sure what kind of talk I'm supposed to be doing here, you really can ask, so are you hoping to get my help with this, or do you just need to talk it through? That way, you can listen and respond in the desired ways. We could debate for hours, based on our own experiences, just how gendered report and rapport talk are. And I hope this will generate good conversation for all of you. In the end, the fact is that all of us should be sensitive to what we're being asked to do in a given situation. We should listen and support, help solve problems, share information, share sympathy, all the things that good conversation can do. A strikingly sensitive issue in both social and professional relationships is names. Perhaps you yourself have gotten your nose out of joint when someone you don't know or don't know well addresses you by your first name, or even more egregiously, a nickname. And you find yourself thinking, who authorized you to call me that? And yet, in an intimate relationship, a nickname or a term of endearment can in and of itself deepen that sense of intimacy. So what do you do if someone gets it wrong? If someone calls you something, and for one of a variety of reasons, you think, no. Do you say something? This actually comes up in etiquette columns fairly often. The fact is, the other person got it wrong, and you have the right to correct it. But you need to realize that you are implicitly asking for an apology, and you want to be sure that is what you want to do in the negotiation of the relationship at this moment. So the answer to the question of, do you correct people? It depends. The decision is whether this is a strategic move, given the overall goals of the conversation, or the goals of that relationship. How do you want to set up the terms of a relationship? And sometimes it may be the right move to correct someone. Now let's turn to the question of whether our conversational style can predict how successful our romantic relationships will be. And to address that question, let me tell you about a study. This study, published in 2010 in Psychological Science by James Pennebaker at UT Austin and his colleagues, was about the relationship of what they called language matching and relationship success. Their question was whether people's similarities in styles of talk could predict the compatibility of people in romantic relationships. And they argue that they can. Now, we already know that people coordinating physical gestures and posture can be predictive. So what about subtle linguistic cues? In terms of those subtle linguistic cues, they studied people's use of selected function words, those little words that we really don't notice, pronouns, articles, conjunctions, to see the extent to which people matched the person they were talking to. And one side of the study was speed dating. The dating where you sit across from the other person for 2 minutes or maybe 5 minutes and decide whether or not you're compatible. They found that high scores for language style matching significantly predicted relationship initiation. So sometimes even if the person said that they weren't interested, in the end they would check that person's box because there was something about the matching there. That matching was a very strong predictor even when people didn't have a sense that they were very similar to the other person. So, if you want to help someone be interested, one possibility is to align yourself with that person's language. Let's look at two sample speed dating conversations from the study. In this first conversation, we're going to see a good amount of language style matching.
Okay, so let's get the basics out of the way. What are you studying?
I'm studying econ and poli-sci. How about you?
Journalism and English literature.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So where are you from?
Iowa, a town of 700.
I'm from New Jersey.
It's probably not a town of 700.
All right. Well, I mean, actually, believe it or not, where I'm from in New Jersey has a lot in common with, like, Iowa and stuff. So how are you enjoying Northwestern?
Well, obviously, the transition is hard from a small town, but I love the city. I'm having a really good time so far.
Okay.
So here, we see the evidence of matching. For example, she says, "I'm from Iowa." He responds, "I'm from New Jersey." His early use of actually is mirrored in her later use of obviously. She asked the question, "What are you studying?" Later, he asked the question, "How are you enjoying?" We see equal clause lengths here with the same kinds of function words. Now let's contrast this with the second example where we're going to see much less language style matching.
Where are you from?
Connecticut. How about you?
Austin, Texas.
Texas, nice. Okay.
When you say football, I understand football.
Oh, okay.
That's just one of those things.
That's, you're a UT fan or a...
Fan would be the wrong word.
An understatement or an overstatement?
No, the wrong word.
Okay.
I've had enough football to last me a lifetime.
Okay. Well, what are you studying?
Opera and mechanical engineering.
That's interesting. Are you in music school?
I am.
Here we see longer questions getting met with shorter answers, including a lot of okay from the man. We also get some syntactic mismatch. In other words, the grammatical structure of their utterances are quite different. For example, she says, "Fan would be the wrong word, a full clause." And he responds with just a noun phrase, an understatement. Now, of course, cause and effect are probably complicated here. One way to show disinterest, often subconsciously, is to disalign your language. So the question here is, are you not interested because this person's language doesn't match yours, or are you not interested and therefore you disalign your language below your level of awareness? Also note that alignment can work to your advantage in professional contexts as well. Aligning your language can be read as a kind of agreement, very subtle, and it proves to be one of the ways to ingratiate yourself. The study cites other ways that pronouns may matter in romantic relationships, and you might find these interesting. For example, couples who use we more often report more satisfaction in their marriages. So they use we more often than you. They also have lower divorce rates. Women who use I or me more often in instant messenger, there's a significant correlation there with relationship stability. What's happening there? Hard to know, but those women may be expressing a kind of independence within the relationship. Alignment can also take the form of nonverbal cues, such as body posture and the direction of your body, hand gestures, and eye contact. So those are all ways that we can align with someone else. But some of these nonverbal actions are also about cognitive load. And let me tell you what I mean by that. This is going to be a little bit of a side, but it's quite interesting. Studies suggest that using our hands eases the cognitive load associated with talking. Talking is really hard work. So when I'm moving my hands, as I'm doing right now, it is easing some of the load of the work I'm doing. There have been studies where people weren't allowed to use their hands. They had to keep their hands quiet while explaining something. And they had more trouble remembering information they were given right before that explanation. Their brains were trying to do too many things if they couldn't release some of that through their hands. So it's not just that those of us who are hand talkers are just waving our hands around for nothing. And eye contact, too, may be associated with cognitive load. When you think about it, one signal that someone is thinking hard is that they avert their gaze. They look down, they look up, they look around, they're thinking. Studies suggest that one primary reason for this may be to reduce the cognitive work that each of us has to do when we look at another speaker. When we look at another speaker, we're reading all the facial cues, we're actually reading their lips when they're talking, doing all of that work. So if we avert our gaze, our brain can think about something else because it doesn't have to do that too. So it's important to know that someone averting their gaze can be signaling that they are thinking about something, especially something that is intellectually or emotionally challenging. So averting one's gaze does not necessarily signal a lack of intimacy. It's actually easier to maintain eye contact, studies show, when you're talking about easy things, not hard ones. As another side note here, eye contact does not consistently predict lying or not lying. At least one study shows that liars may maintain eye contact more as they realize the importance of reading facial cues to see if someone believes what they're saying. An excessive eye gaze can be really disconcerting. It can make us less fluent speakers, and it can sometimes feel almost embarrassingly intimate, especially if speakers are also in close proximity. Now, sometimes parents try to align themselves with their children by using their children's slang. And we all know how well that works. As if your children were not embarrassed enough by you already as their parent, let's try using their slang. The nature of slang is that it is rebellious language. It's trying to be irreverent. It's part of being young. So it really, for the most part, often doesn't work for those of us who are older. So it's something to be aware of, and you experience it when you try it, and younger people laugh. I do this sometimes in class. I'll try out a slang word, and my students are just giving me the signal, you are not of the right age to be using that word. So while younger people may rebel here with slang, I do want to note that they are, in fact, watching adults all the time to learn about how conversations work. So with that, let's turn to parenting. We are, of course, doing many, many things as parents when we're raising children. Or we may be aunts or uncles or other people who are spending a lot of time with young people. One of the things we do as parents or adults is teach children how to talk in appropriate ways. Now, the first thing that may come to mind is that you're teaching children politeness. You're doing things like, what's the magic word? In hopes that the child will say please. Or, what do you say? The right answer there is usually thank you. We're prompting them around these politeness conventions. We may also be telling them not to use particular words in particular contexts to try to help them see words that are taboo, especially in public contexts. But we also model for young people how to talk. Interestingly, we teach babies how to take turns before they can even talk. So you'll see parents responding to a baby gurgling as if they were talking. The baby goes, woo, and they say, that's right, look at the duck. And then the baby smiles and they say, yes, I'm sure the duck will go swimming soon. To try to show they're doing turn taking even though the baby can't talk yet. Children also watch their parents to see how people talk in intimate relationships. They are also watching how caretakers talk. So what we want to remember is that we want to be a role model for children about how to talk in relationships, be those romantic relationships or be that a parenting relationship. And you'll see children imitate our parental talk with their stuffed animals or sometimes with other children, that they will play parent. And you can learn a lot about your parenting talk by listening to your children imitate you. Children also learn politeness not just through our prompting, but also by listening to us. And one of my favorite stories here is of my own niece, who, when she was 4 years old, was greeting someone in the door. One of her mother's friends comes in, a woman, and she's wearing this lovely shirt. And my four-year-old niece says, "What a great shirt! Where did you get it?" Now, she can't possibly have had any interest in actually what store this woman got the shirt from, but she had heard her own mother use that as a greeting, and she was just imitating her. Not to make you completely self-conscious, but I do want you to remember that young people are watching you to figure out how conversations work. And with that transition of thinking about young people, I want to turn to the electronic world, because young people have really been the pioneers in the conversations that we're having electronically. When you think about it, it's not just young people who are having a lot of their conversations electronically. Many of us are typing out our conversations these days on email, texting, BlackBerry Messenger, Instant Messenger, GChat, or something else. So much has changed during our lifetimes. And if you feel anything like the way I do, sometimes it can feel exhausting. We are bombarded with information and conversation. We may feel like we are at the point where we are always on, to quote the title of Naomi Barron's book on the topic. She notes that we now spend some of our time trying to control our interactions, screening calls, managing email, trying to control the amount of conversation we're doing. In some ways, electronic communication makes conversation easier. It allows much more immediate, informal conversation with those far away from us, more than has ever been possible before. It can also mean that we chat in snippets rather than digging in for more extended conversations, which should remind you of the study I mentioned in the first lecture about how our happiness seems to correlate with our moving beyond small talk to more substantive conversations, whatever the medium. And it may be that some media facilitate this more than others. An important thing to realize about electronic conversations is all that is lost, and to recognize how we've tried to manipulate written text to cope with that. So here's what gets lost. A lot of the context. We often don't know exactly where this person is. We also can't read their facial cues, or see their gestures, or hear their laughter. We're not able to get back channeling like nodding to know if someone's engaged. And there's less chance to repair something quickly because it can take a bit to figure out if something's gone wrong. Yet, what's so interesting about this is that electronic conversation is happening so fast that it's like spoken conversation that way, but without all the context we get in spoken conversation. As a result, we have developed sophisticated conventions, or you could call them rules, for how to have conversations in these media. For example, we now often use ha 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 to express laughter. We use all caps to show that we're expressing anger or surprise. Punctuation is also getting used in electronic conversations to capture things about intonation. So you can use a period after each word to show emphasis. I recently got a text from a friend that said, done, period, with, period, grading, period. And I knew exactly how to capture the intonation of that text. Another thing you can use in the electronic world is emoticons, those little smiley faces or winky faces that help capture the context and help someone know that I'm smiling right now or I'm joking, which is really important as a way to avoid miscommunication. You can also use the abbreviation JK, just kidding, to make sure that someone understands what you're trying to say, even as you type it out. We've also created new ways to handle turn-taking and greetings in the electronic world. The fact is that you don't always have to have a greeting, and it may depend on whether you're doing something like texting or using email. Less likely you'll do a greeting on texting than you would do a greeting in email. We've found ways to do electronic back-channeling to show someone that we're still there, we're getting their instant messages as they come in. We can use things like LOL or uh-huh or a little smiley face just to let someone know we're listening. We've also found a way to try to elicit a text or a message from someone. If it's taking too long, you just send a question mark to say, it's your turn. Then there's the use of the symbol asterisk as a way to correct a typo. And I mention this as an example of the fact that this world is just not chaos, that people still care about their spelling, and they'll take the time, if they see a misspelling in a text they sent, to send a second text with an asterisk and the correctly spelled word. But as we've talked about, there are kinds of conversations that still shouldn't happen on email or text. You can flirt, but people say you shouldn't declare your love over text. Maybe you shouldn't even ask someone out. This could be the death of the love letter. It's not a place to get angry or a place to break up. Another way to think about this is that email or text are not very good places for face-threatening acts. It can feel easier because you don't have to see the person and you get to plan it out, but you also can't control the tone, and you can't get an immediate sense of the response so that you can do the needed repair work. My advice to colleagues, whenever they get a complicated email and they want to figure out how to respond, my advice, get it off email or text. Suggest a phone call, or even better, an in-person meeting, and take care of it there. There is much that can be accomplished online, but in the end, face-to-face, human conversation can do more human work. Verbal communication is really important, but so is nonverbal communication. And it's helpful to be able to use all the cues available to make conversations work effectively. I hope you feel that your conversational awareness has been heightened as we've talked about some of the details of how conversations work. I hope you've been noticing things differently. I know people who, with this information, have started to experiment sometimes. For example, they're talking with someone and they try not back-channeling to see how long it takes for the other person to say, "Everything okay?" Another friend of mine with this information was trying to figure out how to do a face-threatening act at work with a very close colleague and started to think about pronouns. So he needed to say, "You need to do this," but in the end asked, "What can we do to help you make that deadline, to make this feel more collaborative?" I hope you will now bring this new level of awareness to your conversations on and offline, making you an especially savvy speaker and listener. As you've seen, there are many ways to say the same thing, and they're often not the same at all in terms of their effects. I wish you great success and happiness in the many conversations ahead of you, at least a few of which, I hope, will be about the fascinating ways that conversations themselves work.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at thegreatcourses.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.